So hello, OG Rose, Daniel and
Hello.
Michelle Gardner.
Hello, Mr. Sweeney. Thank you for having us.
So happy to have you. You are some of our favorite guests on the Parallax podcast. We love talking to you. We love talking to you so much. We asked you to do a course, and your course is called "Look at the Birds in the Air: How We Must Unplan Our Lives." So the purpose of this podcast is to talk about the course, to have you lay it out a bit for us, if you can. And the last thing I should probably say is that the course is part of a series, loosely related to the works of Ivan Illich, and with the theme "Tools for Conviviality." So we're hoping that I'm sure it's going to be a fantastic and convivial course, in November. So why don't you just start by briefly saying who you are and telling us about this course? What's it going to be? What is it all about? Why should we unplan our lives and look at the birds in the air?
Yeah, so I'm Michelle and Daniel Garner, OG Rose, and we read together, and we're also married and have children, and we live on a farm. And yeah, we have several works of writing that are out and kind of available for the public. We also have our own YouTube channel where we publish a lot of our written work, read or summaries of those works. And then we also hold the Net on Thursdays, where we kind of gather some philosophers or thinkers or creatives who want to get together and have kind of spontaneous dialogue about certain topics that's very organic. And so yeah, there's a couple of things out that Daniel and I do. And yeah, really so honored and so excited about this course. And we're tickled that you would think of us and have us join for the series on these courses related to Ivan Illich. And I remember, so just really quick, I remember when we had the chance to be on Parallax talking about literature and philosophy. And yeah, it was definitely one of my favorite conversations. It just was such a fun time, and it was great to have everyone in attendance there and get to have some discussion afterwards. So yeah, I'll pass it to Daniel on the course.
No, we're thrilled to be here, Mr. Sweeney. And Parallax does tremendous work, and we're honored to be in the presence of such great minds like Bonita Roy and her work on Ivan Illich. And she was talking to us the other day about the need to be instruments versus instrumental or instrumentalized, and these very fine distinctions. And I think one of the things that we can look at Mr. Ivan Illich is the need today for very fine distinctions, because there's a whole lot of stakes in these fine distinctions. What is the difference between instrument and instrumental? Oh, everything. And yet they're only two letters off. And how do you tell the difference in your life if you're falling into being instrumentalized, or if you are indeed engaging in an instrumental life, a life that makes music, a life where your tools don't replace you, but extend your humanity? And I think we see in Mr. Ivan Illich a real emphasis on how do we have our tools be extensions of humanity versus replace our humanity? There's only one problem. Nobody uses their tools planning to be replaced by them. Everyone thinks that they aren't being replaced by their tools until one day they wake up and go, oh, wait, something's wrong. And then they may not even have the mental models or the tools or the phenomenological analysis to tell how to get out of that, how to walk back from that. Because these are very difficult things. Like, I haven't met anyone who doesn't think that, oh, we need to spend less time on screens. We don't want to be taken over or captured by the corporations. But then what do you do about that? What would it look like to use screens well? What would it look like to use technology well? And then, of course, if you have to work a 9 to 5 where you're mostly on your computer all day, what do, right? And what do you do if you're building platforms with these technologies? These are very practical. Here's the key. These are very practical questions, but they are not questions that can be answered simply by looking at the practice itself, like the use of the tool itself. There is a additional layer of your relation to the tool that has to be analyzed, and it is not given by the tool itself on what the proper ordering is. The title of the class is an allusion to Matthew 6:33, where Jesus says, "Look at the birds of the air; they neither toil nor reap nor store up in barns, and your heavenly Father takes care of them." And Ivan Illich, famously, as Miss Roy was talking about with the Good Samaritan, your neighbor is the one that you just come upon. You can't plan for it; they're just there. And in fact, if you're too married to your plans or your dogmas, then you'll miss the neighbor because you would never suspect the neighbor to be the one that brings you this moment of disgust or resistance, or they're the enemy, right? And so for us to unplan our lives is not to say that we need to be chaotic, but it's to say that we need to stop treating. Very often it's easy to look at religions and say, oh, they're dogmatic. Oh, they're overly married to their ideas of how the world works and their notions of right and wrong. The truth of the matter is all human beings naturally fall into tendencies of ideology or structures of ethics and right and wrong. And those are the things we need to unplan, to deconstruct, precisely to make a clearing and opening for the neighbor. Like if we look at Derrida, he always tied deconstruction to justice and making an opening for the other. And Ivan Illich, even though he may not like that language of deconstruction, just given the day, there's something very similar there on the idea of how do we make an opening for the other, of which again, I think basically everyone would say, yes, we need to do that, absolutely. But then proceed to engage in life in a manner where they do not identify that they're actually closing off the other. Because it takes the ability to sort of tell, to kind of like tasting wine, to have that fine taste of, oh, this is a red wine of X year and so on and so forth. Likewise, it requires something like taste or very subtle discernment to tell when we're overusing technology or when we're closing off from the other. So what are some of the phenomenological tests? What are some of the personal tests? What are the certain indications that one is going too far, too literal? Because as Roy was also saying, there's such an emphasis on limits in Illich. Well, where do you set those limits? How do you know what those limits are? And the class will be exploring a lot of that.
Okay. As you were speaking, I had a few thoughts. One was about the instrument, and the instrument being the body. Hmm. And I think one of the problems, which Ivan Illich, I always say Illich, you said Illich, but you know, we can say what we want. But one of the problems is of this time is disembodiment. And much of what he wrote about was about incarnation and even what he called carnality and the need to be bodies. So that was one thought I had while you were speaking. The other thing about the Samaritan and chance and the fact that we live in this society that tries to control everything through technology to the point where we become what Gurdjieff called machine man, and we don't see our neighbor. We don't even, we don't have any relationship. So it's like, it's also, I think, a question of attention. Is that along the lines of how you guys are thinking? I think he had a book about attention. I can't remember what it was called, Ivan Illich. But the key issue is how we pay attention to the instrument, to the body, to the.
Yeah, no, I think that's spot on. And I think that, you know, when it comes to look at the birds of the air, there's a kind of a redirecting of your attention, right? To see and pay attention to what do the birds do? You know, what do they, how do they seem to live their lives? And how do they seem to eat and dress themselves and fly and be? And, you know, I think there's something interesting about this because, I know that Bonnie Tavor is really great with horses and animals. We're just talking about this, her like that sort of connection with animals. So it's interesting because this attention and redirection to the birds of the air, and the passage goes on to talk about the flowers, the lilies of the field. Like there's this looking to nature so that we kind of get back to being human, right? So that we can know how to pay attention to our own bodies. You know, it's almost like, well, let's think about what the birds do and then think about how that would relate to what we do with our bodies, you know? And I think that to me, that's kind of fascinating, like where it's a little bit paradoxical, right? Like, shouldn't we just like look more at humans and see what humans are doing? But somehow like humans, like Daniel was saying about, like, you can't just look at the practice and know sort of what the practice should be or what exactly is the best for extension of humanity versus replacing humanity with our tools, our instruments. But I think there's this idea of like having to kind of look to other things that are living their life and living in a way that seems to be almost more simple and in touch with like their own physicality, their own phenomenology, and the world around them, and sort of understand that we can learn something from even like these little small tiny little creatures that can't talk and, you know, can't do the things that humans can do, but we can bring it back and maybe become even more human-like from paying attention to the birds of the air, the lilies of the field. And I think that that's fascinating. But I think too, when it comes to this enfleshment, I love like that emphasis there that Illich has on the enfleshment. And I think that what's important about that is this kind of like bringing into really being able to pay attention to, you know, just the body itself. And I do think it's strange because it's such a simple, it seems like so simple, just like pay attention to your body, pay attention to what it's sort of indicating to you, what it's showing to you. But I think sometimes there is so much distraction. There's so much that can take you away from your enfleshment and your physicality and sort of all of these fine distinctions that then come about. Cause it's like, well, do I need this or do I want this or what? And you know, the body itself kind of has these very primal sort of indicators about things, even just like, I'm hungry, I need to eat this, right? But even paying more attention of like, what exactly do I need to nourish myself with at this time or not? And so there's something really simple there, but there's something really important, just like the fact that sometimes we don't even hear like our own hearts beating or things like this, that sometimes, you know, we could have certain things that we could maybe do on a more regular basis that kind of get us back in touch with the body itself. I think that those are some of the things that were coming to mind when it comes to attention.
No, it's very good. I think it was Simone Weil who basically was like, if we really paid attention, like for her, attention is metaphysically and ontologically loaded. It's not merely to look at something.
Yeah.
It's to give yourself over to the thing entirely and let the thing give itself to you entirely. And for her, this is basically kind of at the center of the religious life. Like if one is incapable of attention, then one is probably incapable of spiritual resonance or something deeper. Now, this would speak to why it would be very problematic if we have technology to today that removes the ability to have attention, really, because we're so moving around that we can't focus on anything, and that would suggest a certain loss of a spiritual dimension of reality. I think also when Ivan is speaking about embodiment, it's very interesting because we actually don't, even often when we think we're getting back to the body, we're not getting back to the body. We're still getting ready to like a simulation. So for example, say, oh, getting back to the body, that would mean using your muscles and using your legs. Well, that's true. But just think about the body. The body's pretty wild in that, one, you have this, Michelle mentioned it, this heart pumping that's invisible, this very concrete reality that everything depends on, that if you ever look at, you're probably dead, and yet it's there. You then have parts of the body that are visible that you can see, like the hand. Then it can get cut open and be bleeding, and you have to make a decision about it. Do you heal it? Do you not? You know, Ivan had that cancer, that part on his neck that he had to make decisions on if he heals or he not. So the body, the other thing too, like out of the body comes speech. Speech is so remarkable because words seem to be these weird abstract entities that are simultaneously really concrete. We're always in the midst of speaking, and yet there are forms of speech that seem to be religious or prayer or different things. There's this great mystery in the human being that can come out in the act of speech. So the body is this wild mixture between physical, metaphysical, concrete, and all these things all together. It's neither merely metaphysical nor merely physical. And for me, when Ivan is saying that we need to get back to the body and we need to think about God as incarnate, then you're thinking about God as multidimensional. You're not thinking about God merely as a thought, an abstract notion, which, by the way, I think he resisted, because then if you say, oh, God is something I can know through, say, rationality, there are no limits to you. You just have to, you can always potentially access more of God and more of God and more of God, right? And it's all right here, right in this current moment of space and time. But if there's something about God in the world, then you need to leave your home. You need to go to the neighbor. There's a limit to the moment that you have to extend in order to access God or the divine, more so, right? So you have to go, and you're limited to whatever spot you go to or person you meet. And wherever you go, you need to give your utmost attention. So if we're going to speak about God as incarnate, then we have to think about God and the spiritual by extension as this very multidimensional, interpenetrating, interrelating way of existence that entails acorns and lilies of the field and birds, but also entails the mystery of the ability to speak, the mystery of how when people are in a room, there's a field or atmosphere of people being together. And the idea too, that would mean that there's always something in, say, the physical that can unfold into something more. So, and that's also going to set limits on what we can know outside of relation, out of figuring out how to make all these different things relate. And then Ivan would say, oh, and by the way, it's human nature to always overfit one of those dimensions, to not set limits on ourselves, to overfit or overextend how much rationality can do, to overextend how much we can do with emotion or with just going out and taking walks in nature. You have to actually think of how to play all of those together if you're going to do the music of life as an instrument. So there's something that's going to require then the fullness of life to be fully human and to fully think about God that I think Ivan is forcing upon us, that Mr. Illich, that is incredibly important. And he would also help us provide tools by which to think about going about that.
It's interesting. You were talking about limits, and in your book, you talk about givens, and it occurs to me that those are the limits, right? And the idea of belonging again, right, which is the title of your book, a very nice book that I have halfway through, is that this idea of belonging again is making relationship with finding the givens or finding the limits again, whereas we've sort of exploded into this limit, seemingly limitless universe, which and so we've lost a sense of orientation or whatever, and I guess the body and language and all these things give us orientation.
No, I think a way to look, that's a very good connection. I think belonging again, you know, which is speaking of Philip Reeve there on givens and releases, is going to say that humans basically are miserable, go crazy, or existentially overwhelmed when there are no givenness to reality, when anything is possible. Because if anything is possible, how do you choose X versus Y? By what standard? Ah, you either have, you're already right there, vulnerable to looking to the system or a strong man or the totalitarian to tell you what you should choose and what you should do. And I think Illich understood that. There's a way to look at Illich and saying, what has happened is we've replace the spirit with system. A way I think about Illich is he's really emphasizing like the Holy Spirit, really, like kind of following the spirit, paying attention to it almost more so than the Father. He does obviously talk about Jesus a lot, but there's this kind of like sense of things that goes back to this tradition of the like praying, meditating the spirit, should I use technology this way or not, and kind of having that. And when, and for most of human history, you could say what we've done is basically relied on givens. Now, of course, the problem, as belonging again tells us, is that that made us susceptible to the banality of evil that Hannah Arendt talks about, thoughtlessness, being controlled, and so on and so forth. So for very good reason, we deconstructed those givens. The problem is we kind of assume that removing limits would be the answer. Like if we just make humans have access to limitlessness, then we're good to go. Well, actually, unfortunately, what ends up happening is in that state that is unprepared for limitlessness, we then turn to the corporation, the system, the state, the government. We just fall right back into various strongmen or all the different, like the education system tells us what to think, as he talks about. We come to assume the dominance or the written word and the ways to think about it, as he talks about on his book, ABC and different things. So today, the challenge is how to choose limits. How to set limits on ourselves or discern limits that aren't given. That is a very difficult practice, but Ivan Illich is absolutely aware of the need to do that. And we can see books and his thinking as kind of wrestling with choosing limits again, as opposed to limits just being given. So you can say that's the difference. In the past, limits were more given. Today, they have to be chosen. Well, that's an entirely different ballgame.
Just as a, you know, banal example of that, I just put my TV in the garage. Because I think you can't function in this world with too much stimuli. You can't do what you need to do. You can't take care of your family if you have too much distractions. So you're forced to you know, give up stuff. You're forced to renounce certain kinds of behaviors and activities, almost like you have to be a bit monastic or whatever in order to function properly, just in the nature of the digital universe. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's a wonderful example. And it's a very important one. And yeah, I think today, you know, it's we have so many more options for distraction, television, iPhones, smartphones, the internet's just endless. You know, there's all these things that can be looked up or known about. And, you know, it's really quite interesting, because then it really does cause a lot of the whole idea of being able to pay attention is once again challenged by these other mediums and such things. So, yeah, I mean, a television is a great example of that. And I was thinking a little bit about this whole idea of like limits and things like this, and the idea of like givens being inherent limits. So, right, like in the past, there was no television, right? You were kind of, in a way, this is why we like the term given, because it's almost a gift that you didn't have to worry about it, right? You didn't have to make the existential decision of if I should stop using, you know, the social media platform or not, or if I should not have the television in the house or not. And they do seem kind of trivial, but they're actually very big, they can feel like really big decisions because, you know, you are either have a habit of using it or, you know, you connect with, you can use it for good stuff. And it depends on what it is and what's your purpose behind it. You know, the television's always been really fascinating to me, just on a personal note. Since I was a child, I would notice the way it would change the atmosphere of a room where everybody seemed to be like focused on the television and they weren't taking time to kind of face each other. And it really struck me as like, oh, that's interesting. And it seems like it can be, I understand why it's not a judgment, but it's just that the television can kind of create an easy out for people ever talking to each other or trying to communicate or think of something to do where they kind of have to actually relate to one another or just learn to sit in silence with one another, you know? So I always paid attention to that when I was younger, but back to the limits idea. So yeah, so no TVs, that your limitation was already given to you, right? You didn't have to really worry about it or make a decision about it. And today we have like, it's absolutely exacerbated all the things that we then now have to kind of decide how we're going to restrict ourselves. And again, it seems so trivial, but it's very existential because—
Well, I like TV, you know, I love, you know, various shows. I can just get completely absorbed in them. So it's not a moral— what I'm saying is not a moral thing. I'm not saying TV is bad and people shouldn't watch TV. Sure. I'm saying, okay, for me in my life and the way my life is set up, that some kind of renunciation, some kind of monastic renunciation is necessary, you know? And I think Illich was a bit the same. He didn't watch movies or, you know, he didn't read a lot of the books that, you know, you guys are familiar with. Like he had ideas like the postmodernists. He had ideas like Deirdre and Foucault, and he had very similar ideas, but he didn't necessarily draw on them. He drew on other kind of his own. He limited his sources to certain things.
What's so fascinating about that point is that, you know, like you're saying, it's not some moral decision, right? It's not like, oh, TV's bad or it's immoral. But even in making that decision, you could potentially be implying that, or you have to wrestle with the fact that what you're doing may seem to be putting some moral gauntlet down about it. And you're not, right? You're just saying, okay, this is not functioning. Like I have other things I really need to do and I really like this. So I actually have to limit myself with that because otherwise I won't be able to feel good actually. Like, yes, I like that. And it feels nice watching that, but it doesn't feel nice when I realize, oh my gosh, like an hour and a half or 2 hours or 3 hours has passed by and I really need to do all these other things. So now you've put a limitation on that. But it's hard because see, in the past, either there was a moral constraint, and not on television necessarily, maybe, but on lots of different things.
On sexuality or whatever, yeah.
And, right, and those things, in some ways, at least you could put this, like, if you didn't like it, you could at least sort of blame it on, like, oh, well, it's a religion, I have to, you know, I can't do this because of this and the other. But you also you didn't have the option to, you know, you did have the option to dissent, right, and maybe do something differently, but you kind of always had the— it was always the thing, it was the religion that made you not want to do it or do something different, or it made you do the thing, right? It made you stay within those confines of that limitation. Now that if that's not there, right, you have to make these choices of doing it or not. And it's not necessarily based on morality per se, but it's based on what you find is most functional for you, or what is in a way optimizes your, well, you know, being in the world or something like this. And so it's a lot. That's why it's so much more existential, because now you are the one who has to decide. And then for everyone who sees what you decide, they think they could take it as a moral judgment on what they decide to do or not do. And you're kind of in this sort of like complete flux of, it's basically a kind of, I want to say, an uncertainty. And it's interesting because I think there's a lot about uncertainty that's important to embrace, but this type of like, not sure, and then you have to make a decision, I guess you have to just either get really, really confident, like in yourself and in what you discern in attending to what you know is going to work better for you or not, and then doing it and just not really caring what other people are doing. That's one route. Or the other thing is that people may just go back to certain givens that they find they believe in, or they lines up with their values enough that they were like, yes, I'll just go ahead and choose these limitations. But the fact that you had to choose it at all is always very existential. There's a book by Barry Schwartz called The Paradox of Choice. And it's a lot about this idea of like,
we all talk about choices being great and everything, and don't get me wrong, we all appreciate it, right? But it's also deeply, deeply, deeply existential, because you always wonder, well, could I be doing it better? Or could I be, is this way over here more right? Or is this over here more rebellious? Or whatever the thing you want to be is, you're always wondering, could I be doing that better? Because you see all these other options, you see all these other choices people are making. So that was a lot, but I just
That's exactly right. The issue is, if you choose to do X, then other people can feel like you're saying everyone should choose to do X, and then you have to explain to each person why you did X, and it doesn't mean they.
And you have your own religion of one, kind of.
That's right. And so that's, so what ends up happening in the modern world is two things. Well, generally two things. One, people just atomize. They get tired of having to explain their choices to everyone around them, so they atomize and they isolate. Or two, they can become very stubborn and mean, basically, where if anyone, they're like, I'm just not going to deal with people. Or the third thing would be going to just the strongman, finding someone that provides those gifts. So the issue is, like, what Philip Reeve and Berger and all these people talk about is that the increase of individual freedom, which is a positive thing, comes with it, though, the ability that if you make a choice, it is very difficult for everyone not to interpret that as meaning you think they should do that as well. And eventually it just becomes so tiring to have to re-explain and re-explain and re-explain that you just stop. And community suffers, in addition to like all the bowling alone stuff with Putman and Neil Postman, the TV with the invisible people on the cover.
Amusing ourselves to death.
And what's interesting with that image, like you were saying with the TV, is, you know, people will talk about love languages, face to face, shoulder to shoulder. Well, traditionally, if you were shoulder to shoulder, you were working on a car, working on a TV. It was an active social, it was an active shoulder to shoulder. Now you have this kind of passive shoulder to shoulder that seems quite different, that can create this kind of vanishing. I mean, the other thing, too, is the moment the camera is invented, every tree is a potential photograph. Even if you don't have a camera, you know you could buy one and thus take a picture, right? Every party you go to, every moment of it, it could be a photograph or could be a tweet. And so your relation to everything in reality with every technology changes, even if you don't have the camera, because you could have the camera, right? And so what Ivan Illich identifies is that as you have that increase of possibility, by what standard do you decide if you take a picture at this part of the party, but not at another part of the party? Well, people know that if you see me taking pictures when the kids are playing over there, then you see me not taking pictures later on when all the guys are together. So are you saying the kids are more important than the guys? Well, I don't want to say this, so I'll take another picture. And then everyone's at the party then constantly taking pictures nonstop, just because there's a moral signaling that they think everything is worth taking a picture. So then what happens is the technology, which changes the toredness of what everything can be, gets added with an ethic. And everyone doesn't want to be seen as not caring or not tweeting, and everything's a potential content. So then the technology, there's no limit. It overtakes. Ethic plus possibility equals limitless engagement with the technology. And it ceases to be an instrument and instead instrumentalizes us. This is the problem that Illich, and you know, Alex Eber does such great work on freak theory on the problem of limit, right? Like, what is a cancer cell, but it won't limit itself and it won't die, right? And so then things become cancerous. And what Ivan Illich identifies is that dynamic is unfolding in education and medicine and school with the written word, all of these different things, ways of seeing. I mean, you can do the H2O water. We see everything's just as mechanical. We don't see the poetic element as well. Like, and then it spreads, because if we choose not to see that way, then everyone sees we're choosing an alternative, which they interpret as meaning they should do it as well. And then that creates all these problematic social dynamics. You could even say, I guess, game theory dynamics that are problematic. And Illich basically understood that in that context, people are either instrumentalized or they just let the system think for them because it's too tiring. It's too overwhelming. And so then they get, you know, controlled.
Yeah, really quick, and like with this example of taking pictures of things, but this, you know, the other element comes up too, where you think to yourself, oh, I'm taking a picture when I should be enjoying the moment. Like you just feel wrong either way. Like, it's That's like, right. You're wrong if you're taking pictures, you're wrong if you're not taking pictures. So this is where this like radical kind of existential choice comes in, where you just decide, like, I'm going to either take a picture, I'm not going to take a picture, and I'm going to live with that and be okay with it. And, you know, this can all sound like there's a lot of like almost overthinking, but this is the risk of not having givens. There's a lot more thinking and a lot more deciding, and this is not necessarily bad at all, but it does mean that people are going to be a bit like have to deal with some more existential questions, or just not think about it and just do what everyone else is doing. That's, you know, that's an option too. But then you can, like Daniel's saying, you can be manipulated with that. You could be captured, you know. So anyways,
those are fascinating. It's like you could either become a total infant in a way, you know, or you could become a real adult. You don't have this in-between place that the religions provided, exactly. or something like that, right?
Yeah, that's a really, that's fascinating. And I do think it's, you know, I was thinking about this a little bit actually today, this idea of like childhood and adulthood and the things that would normally kind of progress people into their adulthood and how all those things have sort of changed a lot in like the, and masses mostly, like the fact that on the whole, those barometers and those markers have changed, and how, you know, religion, some of the great things about religion would be that it would provide those things for people. And they often were tied to the flesh, like, you know, in terms of, you know, at least for females becoming a mother or things like this, where, you know, your sexuality was tied to your procreation and you were going to, that was a kind of rite of passage, or things like this, or things that just would naturally happen to the body. The cycle starts for the female, you know, and there's just sort of certain things that kind of like would provide those markers. Now, without that, then people can either go and believe and kind of live with those markers, or they can create their own markers. But it can be challenging, especially because you're dealing, like, this is literally the passage from child to adult, and usually you'd have elders who kind of give the rhythms of what that is, whatever the ritual is, whatever the, you know, where there's this sort of, there would be people who were older than you who'd been doing this for a while, who would kind of share with you what that was. And, you know, it's difficult to know now, like, well, who are the elders with this knowledge? Is it just that there are no rituals, but we are kind of ritual like by nature in our being human. So we end up finding some things that we kind of count as like our practices for coming of age or whatever it is. And a lot of times it could be tied to the market, you know, as well. So yeah, but I was just thinking about this idea of, childhood and then adulthood. And the thing is, like you said, religion kind of provided this space of like sort of a little bit more of an in-between, where like you're always a child of God, right? So let's just take that simple concept, right? Mm-hmm. In a way, you got to always be a child, right? Like you're always a child of God. But also being a child of God meant to, like, you know, run the race, and it meant to, you know, in some ways take on the proverbial, quite literally, from, if we're thinking about scripture, proverbs, knowledge and wisdom, to actually do those things and become like somebody who can give to others as well as not just receive, you know. So I think religion did it in some ways, like it seems to be like at least that it's really difficult to find a way to be able to do both, right? Where you can be a child of God but still be matured, right? How do you have that without, like, you know, the givens, unless you sort of start to create it yourself? And I think there are many people trying to like make that effort for what that could be themselves, and perhaps that could be better. But anyways, I just want to speak to that, like where it can do both, and the bothness. We talked, Daniel talked a lot about this, how the bothness is very in line with it, even Illich in his work. Yeah, go ahead, Daniel.
No, I think what ends up happening, and I think Ivan Illich understood this, you know, Neil Postman basically in his book, The Disappearance of Childhood, says an adult is someone who's literate, right? Like you get, like, if you're literate, you're an adult, right? Well, now being an adult means you have a career and you have a job, right? And or you participate in the system in a certain way. Mm-hmm. And that's not, you know, we have to be careful, you know, Illich didn't even think that systems were inherently bad. No one is saying that. The issue is that systems have a tendency to do your thinking for you. Yeah. Illich is not anti-technology. It's very difficult for any of these thinkers. Yeah, well, that's actually part of the problem. Like the moment somebody critiques something, you assume they're against it. That actually speaks to everything we were saying about your own independent choices or the photo. Like the moment Illich is like, hey, you know, maybe you shouldn't go to the hospital for every time you're sick. He's like, oh, so what? You're anti-doctors or whatever? He's like, I'm just saying that there's actually, you know, health doesn't equal medicine, right? You know, you may want to think about health more holistically. Well, he's anti-doctors, right? That's what the brain does. And that actually goes to show you right there that the brain is naturally part of the problem.
Is
the
binary thinking, you mean, sort of?
What's that, sir?
Like binary thinking, either yes. Or thinking?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I,
like,
and
okay, you either know, you're on this side of the equation or you're on the, or you're one of the others.
That's exactly right. And, you know, not, I have to get my Hegel quota. For Hegel, we are all naturally in understanding, which is binary, which the reason he does the whole dialectical motion is to show that a binary always basically entails the otherness of the other side of the binary. It doesn't make even any sense unless it passes over to the other side. So then by the end of the Phenomenology of Spirit, he's like, well, if that's the case, then logic isn't what we think it is, and we need a new logic. And then you go to the science of logic. Like the dialectic in Hegel is all a setup for the speculative reason of a different kind of thinking that we don't even realize we need to do, because we always think that thinking is figuring out the right side of the binary. And Illich is right on that. He's like, look, we get captured in this thinking that you're either for the system or you're against it. And as a result, there's no limit. There's no decision. There's no choice. There's no personal customization. And in that situation, of which, of course, is existentially very difficult for all the reasons Michelle was saying, in that situation, then the human is lost. You know, our technologies, our tools, our systems, they're not going to extend humanity. They're going to replace humanity. And that's what we find ourselves in. But in order to overcome that, you have to make choices. You have to make decisions. Like today, and then I'll give it back to you. Like, there's this real emphasis today that everything is bothness, right? That the Republicans have truth, but the Democrats have truth as well. Freedom is important, but equality is important as well. There's always this kind of bothness. Like, technology is good and bad, and it's all trade-offs. And obviously, we talk all the time about tragedy and different things. And then obviously, even Hegel with the dialectic. Here's the thing, though. If it's always bothness, then the question is the proportion of that bothness and where you make the choice in the midst of that bothness. Is it 40% freedom and 60% equality, or is it 70% freedom and 30% equality? There is a decision that has to be made on the relation of the bothness. You can't just say it's both and be done with the issue. You then have to make decisions of the bothness. Oh, crap. That means we have to take on risk and make choices and be existential, right? So that's what we see. Like, this is
we're opt out, you know.
Well, that's what happens.
Voting, right? Yeah.
That's right. And to me, this is one of the reasons why Ivan Illich is a thinker for the moment, is because we've kind of reached this point now where I would say the baseline of thought is most people, even on the street, I think, would say that it's both. Like, they're going to say we need both. You'll hear that it's both. Both, everyone is right in different ways. Okay, well, if that's the baseline, now the question is the organization and choice of the relation of that bothness. And Ivan Illich understood that. Like, he is constantly putting forth a need to make a choice so that our tools are instruments as opposed to instrumentalizing us. And I think Illich is kind of framing this issue of how to choose the relation and proportions of the bothness.
Okay. Maybe we could go back a little bit to the course and talk about the course that you guys are going to teach, which begins on November 4th, and there are four sections. One is on motivation, one is on self-forgetful education, absolute choice and conditioning, enjoying, improvising, auto-mastering, and unplanning for the unknown. Anyway, all these tantalizing titles. Do you think you could go through them a little bit, perhaps, and tell us what you're going to teach on these days and how the course is going to be structured, what you guys are going to do with the students?
No, I that's a lovely question. Again, we're thrilled to have that opportunity. The Illich motivation, we're going to be like on this question of what's the difference between extending humanity and replacing humanity. And we're of the opinion that a lot of it has to do with the question of motivation. Like, if you're paying attention to yourself, like, are you motivated to do X because of an external prize or because you see some sort of inherent value in doing that thing? It's kind of like Nietzsche's child. Like, this is good to do for its own sake. Like, so for example, Benito was talking about the instrument. Very often people will play guitar. If you're not a professional musician, you're doing it because there's something wonderful in the act of making music itself that is enlivening, right? That the world is worse off without it than with it. Well, the theory, you know, one of the things we'll be talking about is the idea that very often determining our relation with our tools has something to do with paying attention to the very experience of our motivations, really looking at them and sort of gauging if we are doing this for a motivation that's going to lead to instrument or instrumentalizing ourselves. Because I think, you know, a big thing we'll talk about is unfortunately, we spend a whole lot of time emphasizing ideas. Do you have the right ideas? Do you have the right beliefs? Well, honestly, motivation is a little deeper than that, because you can have the right ideas and it not motivate you to do anything. You can have ideas of how the world will work, but that doesn't necessarily compel you in any way. And likewise, you can have the ideas of how the world is supposed to work, and that's precisely why you end up captured. So talking about motivation, because I think even like where your talk with Benita and Carly, where he was talking about with Ivan Illich, which was quite moving on this idea that he may have never written down this kind of these master ideas in his thinking until the end of his life. He was willing to let the ideas pass through him. Well, right there, what you see is in Illich, this kind of awareness of a need to sense the motivation. Am I doing this for the right reason? Am I thinking that I have to put these ideas in the world or the world will end? It's all up to me. Well, that's not a good motivation because you have a savior mentality. But then there's also a problem where you just assume that you should never do it because it would always be selfish or problematic, right? So this kind of sense of a change of the motivation in the air. And how
just a question here about motivation, because also there's the Holy Spirit. So I think he was listening to that and that he would say that his motivation is a sort of inspiration from beyond himself. It's not like self-motivation. That's just you know what I was thinking about, because often we talk about motivation, we're thinking about self motivation, which isn't necessarily the best. You know, it doesn't necessarily lead to the best results, I find. Does that make any sense?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, people can often be very motivated to do very horrible things are very self, you know, just gratifying. And like, it's very selfish. And it's, you know, it's like, we often find ourselves very like, oh, we've got a lot of energy to do the wrong thing and no energy to do the right thing or whatever it is. But I think this is like what I you know, in the first segment with like on motivation, thinking about the actual phenomenology of motivation, like it's your energy. And how do you find a way to use that energy for, you know, things that are in line with the things you are after, you know, the things that you're really after. I think there's this definite tension between like the inner and the outer, the pulling and the inner, like there's this sort of a out there and in here that have to kind of like be kind of in a gravitational force to be able to actually have that motivation be something that's ultimately a good motivation. You know, it's motivation to do the things that are actually ultimately, you know, beautiful, true, and good, and ultimately best for you and those around you and for the world, you know? I think, and it actually ties really well into the next segment we'll be doing on November 11th, which is on self-forgetful education. And, you know, we really tried to make the course a lot about like the ideas that we have cultivated and that, you know, we would love to be able to share with others, that you can also find, you know, references. We'll have works that are referenced for each of these segments so that, you know, you can see kind of where we have derived them from and why they are important to us. But with self-forgetful education, it has a lot to do with this idea of like, what does it mean to be self-forgetful, but still have motivation, right? So it's like, motivation is a very individual thing, right? Like, I feel motivated today to make breakfast, or I don't, right? But you know, I'm gonna have to do it anyway. But see, there's this element here where you have to kind of understand how these two things go together, and ultimately how all of the things we're gonna be talking about go together, which they do, because you can't just have, if you just have motivation, but it's not in line with self-forgetfulness, then it can become very selfish and very much a motivation just for your own gain. Not that there's anything wrong. Like, we have to also get into like, well, is your own gain always bad? Well, no, it's not always bad, but it can be bad. It just depends, right? It's very situational. It's very particular. So in November 11th, we'll be talking about self-forgetful education. We also want to tie that in with like the idea of cultivating and raising children. We homeschool our kids. So it's sort of a way to be able to share how we sort of view and think about education at large, and also how it helps us to be sort of like the Nietzschean self-turning wheels, where we learn to understand the really wonderful traits and qualities that children seem to inherently have. And they are, you know, a lot of times I think there are some different paradigms about how people think about children, but ultimately they are very much in the world, right? They're very much in the moment. They're not thinking about, you know, they're not worrying about the future. They might be excited about or ask you about like, when's Christmas? How many days until Christmas or whatever it is? But they're very, very present. They're so present that they don't really know what day it is or care, you know, like. And so there's something about this sort of this childlikeness that we really want to tie to self-forgetfulness and education, which then it really feeds in really well with how to think about motivation in a way that, again, extends you as a full human being, or like enfleshed, versus it being this replacement, which then if you if you end up like replacing your humanity, you often think you're doing it for yourself. And it's like, you know, for all this good for yourself, but you end up like, it's really detrimental to yourself. Ultimately, you know, that's the irony, like some of the things that are most like for you and you get this, that, and the other, and you possess that, this and the other, ends up really hurting yourself and other, your relations. So that's going to be November 11th on self-forgetful education. And that's what I would answer on the question of motivation. I don't know if that, like,
yeah, well, I have a few thoughts, like just quickly before I pass to OG about what you said. My son is 3 years old and he's wandering around the garden and he says, "Dad is the snail," you know, and he's so excited by a snail, you know, and then I come and look and I see the little, you know, the amazing architecture, the infinitely beautiful architecture of a snail. And so in a way, being a child of God is being able to see that. It's not being infantilized before a big other or some Lacanian thing. I don't think it's in the sense that you could say it. It's being attentive and being able to be attentive to that pure impression.
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I think that's spot on. Definitely. That wonder, that sense of wonder. Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because we spoke about attention. And I think this will get into the absolute and conditioning on an absolute choice on November 18th.
Yeah.
Is that in the act of true attention, which I think Illich is all about and Simone Weil, there is a self-forgetfulness, but it's not a self-humiliation. And this is where we reference the Timothy Keller book that's so good, is like self-forgetfulness is where you are lost in the wonder of the act or the thing. It's kind of the collapse of the subject-object divide, where then your world, like self-forgetfulness is a state of worldling, like you're like worlding in a way. Mm-hmm. And so you see that, because right now we're cut, you know, we were talking about binaries, like it's selfish or selfless. And you see, you can be stuck in that forever. And both of those reinforce an I-world division, subject-object divide. And basically to get to the instrument, what happens like in the video Benito was showing of playing the instrument? The guy's lost on the guitar. There is no guy at that point. There's also no guitar. It's like I-guitar all blend together, right? And this, the effect of music tends to come out in this kind of self-forgetfulness. But the question is, how does one go about engaging in that? Well, that's going to require conditioning, creating.
Or you could also say self-remembrance. It could be the same thing.
Sure. And for Keller, it is basically the, if you forget the, like I know Benito was saying, and I think it's correct with Mr. Dempsey on this idea that there's a way in which the self is a mistake, like where consciousness is creating the notion of an ego as you, and you actually in that act of thinking of yourself or not forgetting of yourself. And that's always what's that kind of logic that you could say many of the great religions and theologies, and I agree, they understood that. East, West, like whatever religion you want to talk about, not every religion, but basically they have this understanding that there were always these very interesting paradoxical moves where the act of forgetfulness turns out you're now actually open to the true self, really. It turns out that when you actually lose yourself in the music, it turns out that the music is you. But you had to be open to that possibility. And that also, again, to my second Hegel quota, would get us into this paradoxical notions of contradiction at kind of the heart of reality. That when you understand that, the reason why contradiction is at the heart of reality is because it turns out reality is alive. And things do not stay in a stagnant state, but are moving, which thus makes them seem like they're a contradiction. But really, that's just a result of the unfolding of time. And the question becomes, how does one condition themselves to be more open to that or better than that? And conditioning is a term that also is alluding to what for me is a between space between subject and object. You know, we say, oh, you're being subjective. Oh, you're being objective in these different things. And that kind of language is another example of a binary that has been very problematic. So if I were to ask you, we've all walked into a room that had a certain aura or energy or atmosphere, right? Where it's like, oh, this is a good time. People are having a good time here, right? Is that objective or subjective? It doesn't seem to be either, does it? Because if you were to say, oh, it's just your subjective appearance, no, you can look around, people are having a good time, and you didn't, also too, you didn't will to have that experience of the kind of party experience when you walked into the room. It was just there. It existed, the atmosphere existed independently.
So it's neither subjective nor objective. It's just, it's not you, and it's not something out there either.
No.
It's the total symphony of that experience.
100%. It's just like, is the music that the guy's playing on the guitar, is that objective or subjective? It doesn't seem to fit. The existence of the music is very much recordable and objectable and observable by any given subject, right? And yet the music would not exist if there wasn't a subject who had an idea of good music to play it on that instrument, right? And so what we see is there's an ability to condition reality, to create conditions relative to your own conditioning in certain abilities and talents that can create a different experience in a room. And I would argue that also that ability has a lot to do with creating spaces for friendship, Ivan, conviviality. You know, Ivan is so concerned about the question of being a good friend, having friendships, having relationships. Well, if all you can think is in terms of subjective or objective, how do you be a good friend? Oh, well, that's your subjective opinion. And there is no objective way to be a good friend. So we're screwed. We'll just get lucky. If we have good friends, great. If we have bad friends, there's nothing we can do about it. Yeah, but actually, there's a conditioning that can go into it.
Yeah. No, I was just saying that often what is so fascinating with Illich as me is how deep his concepts of these things are. So by friendship, he doesn't mean, like, we have such a banal idea of what a friend is. It's just somebody we know. And, you know, I've had that experience where I've gone to a dinner party with, you know, with my wife and to somebody's house, and we're supposed to be friends, but there's nothing there, you know, or the opposite. So you meet some stranger and you feel like you've known them for 1,000 years and you have this incredibly deep connection. So what is a friend, you know, exactly? I think, and is a friend somebody who just is just going to bolster your ego or confirm your identity, or who agrees with everything you say, or is this somebody who challenges you? And so I think he has a beautiful notion of friendship. And also this idea of the Samaritan is not like the big kind of revelation for me with Ivan Illich is how he thought about care, and this moment where he takes the Samaritan takes the guy who's covered in maggots and naked, and as Benita says, maybe has an erection, this disgusting person who's outside of his tribe and his identity, and decides to make a choice to, you know, it's not charity, it's not something that people do in any institutionalized way. It's like pure relationship. So anyway, that's what I really feel like is what blew me away in about his notion, you know, of friendship and conviviality and relationship.
Yeah, no, that's wonderful and really, really important. And I really like that emphasis in the way you and Bonita were talking about the idea of like the disgust, right? It's like, it's not just disgust and then you're either completely like, this is out there, but there can also be, I think today, a lot of jouissance in disgust, where people find it like a strange sort of perverted, even sexual pleasure to disgust, and they kind of want to, like, it's a strange sort of place.
It's not that either.
It's not that either. I don't think so. I think that it's truly being disgusted by something and yet saying, I will extend an embrace, I will extend help. Like, and you know, I think these are very almost like quotidian, and again, it's so crazy how some of the most like seemingly trivial things are really, really actually the most important ripe things for you know, conviviality and for beauty, for truth, for goodness, for this sort of strange wonder to break through. Because Bonita was talking about taking care of her mother, right? And it's like these things where it's like an older person who is, you know, they literally have to, like, they're soiled themselves, they have to be changed, and yet she's going to do that work and she's going to stand by her mother and say, I do this because I love you. And I remember that you changed my diaper when I was an infant. Like, there's this, and I was thinking about like with motherhood a lot, right? Like, just funny examples of like, they're funny and I can laugh about them, but you know, to somebody looking on the outside, they're like, that's gross, you know. But it's like, well, it's gross, but it's also, you know, it's my own flesh and blood, and also it's, we are all flesh and blood to each other in this strange humanity that we are, you know. So there's this sort of disgust and grossness that doesn't, there's really nothing pleasurable about it, and yet somehow you say, I will still help you. And I, and not just from a place of like, cause I'm a better person or cause I'm doing, no, it's just because you do it. You do it because they're there and they need it. And you need to do that too. You know, there's a, this sort of like mutual need. It's not just the one person being needy and gross and you being like, I'm going to help you. I'm better than you. I'm cleaner than you. Right. You'll also be in a position where you've, you know, like thrown up on yourself and stuff like this. Like there's this real, like, I think, tied to this, like the very basic things of life that are, that could be again seen as gross. And you know, like a child can just throw up all their food suddenly because they didn't like the way your soup tasted or something. They made them gag. Now they're throwing up everything everywhere. And you're like, you know, and you just wanted to make like a nice dinner. Like these things happen so regularly in motherhood or in taking care of the elderly or in taking care of those who are different places in terms of their own independence. And I think it's so important that we not shy away from those areas of life. And we, but yet like truly, truly, these things are completely tucked away in society, right? School, you never see people giving birth or, you know, somebody dying because they're elderly or sick. Like these things are so tucked away. And I get it. Like it can be difficult and it can be seem like irrelevant. And it could seem like, well, why? Like, why would we even, you know, we don't. But I think there's oddly enough in pushing it all away, I think it creeps up in these other perverted jouissance ways, you know, where people actually seek out seeing certain things because it's that sort of strange, you know, pleasure with it.
I'm seeing zombies when you're talking. I mean, if we don't face suffering, right? That's what we become.
I think you're quite right about that. And I think that there's something about the vulnerability of, you know, even the fact that somebody would rely on you to, you know, there's something so radically vulnerable about somebody dying, about a child, about, and these things are all part of our human existence. We act like we've never been children or that we're not going to age one day. And yet like, these are really, really core things that, you know, we have to sort of face head on and realize like that is a tragic part of our human condition, but it also means we're alive. It also means we have relation. It also means we care. We care. I care about cleaning up my child and helping them not have throw up on them. And I'm not going to shame them just because I had a gag reflex because they didn't like my soup, you know, like you just, you clean them up and you say like, oh, I guess you didn't like the way that tasted. And you know, you just do that. And I think those things like it's not to like, these are not nothing that can be like, you know, it's weird because it's hard to not talk about it without trying to then seem like you're erecting a new heroic or heroism, right? It's not that though. It's just about doing the day in, day out work that goes into life itself. But we kind of get to this sort of like adult independent stage where we forget like needs and human needs that are very, very common that we have ourselves, you know?
It's interesting. He talks about the movement from the prophetic religion to the friendship. So I was thinking of that when you were talking, you know, it's not a grandiose kind of gesture. It's just the basic human stuff.
Exactly.
Human, you know, material.
And I don't know, I wonder if it's just that people feel like or a lot of our institutions don't know, like that's just, it's like under everybody or what? I don't know what it is. It's almost like it's just strange to me because a lot of like institutionalized or more systematic way of educating people, it doesn't really include that unless you want to be a nurse, right? And then if you want to be a mother, well, that's not on the career chart. But you know, like, I just think it's interesting to me because it's like, maybe we just feel like, will someone else will take care of it? I think there's a lot of outsourcing, to be honest, that can.
Well, I mean, so a few things. First off, it seems easier for the modern to see an explosion or a bomb go off than to see vomit, which is interesting because there's some sort of difficulty with fluid and bodily fluid. Like it's more easy for us to see bombs and military and different things than these fluids in different things. And that's interesting. And it would suggest, one, I do definitely associate the disgust with the gag reflex, where when you come upon your neighbor's the one where you have, like you could have a gag and you're able to kind of, and you fight through it, you know, and you go through and you don't let the gag then be the, like the decision. Oh, I gag, therefore this is a bad person. You walk away, right? Cause that's easy. There's a way in what has happened, you know, there's a number of history books that will talk about the doctrine of purity and how civilizations tend to create themselves relative to purity versus dirty. And we moderns, we're above that. We don't do that anymore. No, we still do. We still have a purity doctrine in the form of like the, rational, that's rational. Oh, it's clean then.
Yeah, rational means clean. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, and so what, you know, what Ivan Illich is often like, oh, you just go take medicine. It's clean. It's like a, like decision making has a certain cleanliness.
Or it's been divinely ordained as being good. You know, he talks about the religiosity of these institutions. Like this medicine has been, you know, stamped by the food, you know, the whatever organization says it's clean. So we can take this particular medicine. Yeah. There was often medicines before used to make you gag, didn't they? You know, yes. Most of them, and some of the more effective like ones would make you vomit, or you know, or even psychedelics, or you know, taking ayahuasca. You part of that is experiencing this revulsion or you know, getting out the, you know, the sickness.
Oh yeah, well, and also like the definitions of words are clean. Oh, this is what it means. It's clean, right? Likewise, yeah. Water is H2O. It's not this poetic, messy thing. So there's this way in which the modern world, and you can see, like, again, Derrida at his best is returning the messiness of words. It's a floating signifier, always in play, right? And it's never kind of anchored down on something. And you know, Illich is critiquing all of these ways in which we've returned a certain purity doctrine back. And likewise, when you're talking about God, you know, when he's talking about God as enfleshment, the flesh, and it's very interesting, this word flesh, not matter, because there's something about the word matter that's very septic, very clean and kind of mechanical, but it's enfleshment, like, oh, it peels and it gets calluses, and God has calluses and different things. And there's this way in which what Ivan is saying is we need God to be messy. Like, God is too pure for us, you know, in the sense of he's this clean sort of concept, when really in that circumstance, then this is the problem. The human is messy. They're not a precise being. Life is not precise. If it was, it'd be dead. And yet we associate the true with the precise and the predictable and the systemizable. Under that circumstance, the human must be replaced. You've created an ethical system of purity that associates the clean, ergo the mechanical, with the true. Well, then everything has to be that. And so then when everything's captured and we're like, oh my gosh, modern life is so predictable and everyone is captured by, well, yes. Because that's the ethical system you created. And he is critiquing that. And likewise, you're saying, yes, we have this emphasis on medicine, but medicine, well, health now equals pills. It doesn't mean the process of dying or different things. I mean, people talk about, like, you don't tell, let's put it this way. When you go to school, people are like, oh, you should be a doctor. They don't say, oh, you should go into hospice. Like, there's not this emphasis on being with people in death. Yes, people get those careers, but all of the language, all of the thinking is aligned with status, proceeds, and not dealing with the messiness of the body. But actually what you're doing is doing operations to remove the messiness of the body, or to kind of get away from the body. And likewise, education is not educating the whole person. It's about giving the right answers to the trivia problems, the heads on the stick. So education is very clean. So why, you were mentioning elders earlier. Well, why do you need elders? You don't need elders because you got all the clean answers from school, right? And likewise, you don't need to have like Charles Taylor enchanted version of the world that sees everything as alive and poetic, or he makes the example of water. No. You just need to know its chemistry, chemical composition, or how physics works, and then you're done, right? So it's this return of a purity doctrine in disguise, really, that then Ivan Illich is helping us work through, in my opinion.
His idea of counterproductivity and iatrogenic, you know, illnesses, that all of our cure, all of these solutions, you know, to everything, you know, turned out to create, you know, massive problems. Like, I think everybody could read Ivan Illich and look at COVID and you know, learn a lot about what humanity went through during the COVID crisis from him and
Well, in the way, and then I'll give it to you, it's like when we talk about conditioning, it's a question of how do we make healthy, if there's not a subject-object divide, there's a question of how to have a healthy worlding where subjects and objects are always together. How do you have a healthy interaction between those things? Well, it can't be just on the side of the subject or of the object, because it's both in the worlding. So how do you condition the world in such a manner to create a healthy world, a healthy life that has this atmosphere, or where the instrument creates the music? Because it won't do simply to be objective, nor will it do simply to be emotional or subjective or rational. Life is more like a recipe than it is solving a math problem. To have the right ingredients in the right order, with the right timing, with the right heating, how do you create those conditions? And on that I also think, without getting too much into it, actually has a lot to do with what he's talking about with friendship, in how to create this certain atmosphere, this certain way of things. I think it can get into Nietzsche. Nietzsche was big on friendship. But actually, to me, I'm very fascinated when Plato talks about music, Socrates' music as the beginning of education. I think that has a lot to do with friendship. And also Alan Bloom at the end of The Closing of the American Mind. And you could also go to Cicero, where they're talking about basically without the humanities, without the arts, without philosophy, friendship is over. And he's basically predicting these books like Lost Connections by Heidegger, the French session that people are talking about, because people do not have this ability to condition their lives to then create a sense of music in which friendship can be cultivated. And Ivan Illich has his finger right on that.
Just want to mention real quick, like the last session we'll be having is on enjoying improvising automastery and unplanning our unknowns. And I think there's something about this idea of like what Daniel's talking about with condition. The really interesting thing about that, though, is that in some ways it's not, it's like, you know, it fits well with like the idea of conditioning your body, right? Like you condition your body. So then you know, you're not exactly sure what you'll necessarily have to do, but you're ready. Like you could lift the 300-pound weight if you needed to, right? Cause you did your conditioning. And I think there's a lot of it like that, where it's not so much that you like set these kind of rigid fixed conditions, but more so that you condition yourself so that you can handle and even like welcome the unknown and allow yourself to enjoy that, like actually enjoy the unknown. And that's why I wanted to just touch back really quick on this idea of like, I'm not trying to say that like pleasure is evil or bad at all. Like we can never, I don't think we should ever really kid ourselves into thinking we don't take like pleasure out of certain things. But I just think that we should be aware that when we talk about the Good Samaritan, or we talk about this sort of this moment of disgust, it's purely disgust. There's really nothing more to it but the gag reflex and being like, oh my gosh, I don't want to handle this, but I'm going to actually, you know, get my hands dirty, or, you know, actually help and like be here for this. And finding the pleasure in actually this repetition of cleaning and the repetition of like encountering what's disgusting, but still embracing it and loving it, and finding a higher pleasure in that, a greater pleasure, a greater enjoyment, I think, from that. And so, yeah, it's also not to like deify, you know, aging and death and stuff like this. Like these are real hard things, you know, but we just can't, we also mustn't pretend that like they're not a part of life, right? Because they are a part of life. So yeah. I just wanted to speak on that really quickly. But yeah, I think there's a lot too, where for me, like, I think a lot about how this idea of like the improvising is a lot of like the musicality, right? Where when you improvise, you don't know exactly like what your companion's going to do on the saxophone, but like, you're playing the piano, but you listen to each other and you suddenly you're like improvising, and your improvisation comes from your own comfort in that instrument where you've practiced yourself, or you have gotten confident enough to make mistakes, but you still keep going to improvise and to continue mm-hmm. to make, like, you know,
which is a conversation, right? To like yeah. what we're yes. doing right now.
Absolutely.
This is an improvisation, absolutely. Improvised conversation. We're creating conversational jazz, so to speak.
Yep. Yeah. That's why I like the jazz, where you're like, let's riff and jazz, because it's absolutely that. Absolutely.
Well, I mean, it's basically friendship has a lot to do with the ability to engage in improvisation in the music. And like mm-hmm. what ends up happening is what has happened is, because our systems do our thinking for us, because our tools do our thinking for us, because we've had our humanity replaced versus extended generally, we then go into friendships transactionally. Mm-hmm. We go into friendships basically to watch movies together or to do things together, which aren't inherently bad, but they are when you are doing it to hide the inability to be part of the music, to engage in the music in different things. But again, nobody intends to end up that way. Nobody intends to be boring or to bore or to find themselves bored or to find themselves. No one wakes up one day and says, you know what? I want a meaningless life. These are things we slip into, that we creep into, because we don't have the phenomenological, and by phenomenology, I mean experiential, the ability to tell in our quality of experience when it is an indication that we are slipping into something that one day we're going to wake up and not want to be in. And I would say a lot of the class has a lot to do with that, like noticing changes in experiences. What are the kinds of experiences that's an indication that you're slipping away from the ability to improvise? Yeah. What is indications in choice making that is an indication that you're losing the ability to make high quality choice, to not be able to engage in what we call the absolute choice, which would have a lot to do with this ability to make a decision by your own values yeah. and not be a nervous wreck over it because mm-hmm. the neighbor doesn't agree with it. Like what is the emotional experience that is a matter of emotional intelligence, not just emotion. You have to, it's like this ability to kind of sense it, like tasting wine. That is an indication that one is in self-forgetfulness, not selflessness or selfishness. And what is a kind of sense of motivation that would give you an indication that you're engaging in the right kind of motivations? And this is where we're also, to close the point, we talk a lot about phenomenological pragmatism, which today the problem is we don't have a category for this kind of practice or being practical. We have being practical equals pick up a hammer and hit a nail, but there's actually a whole set of practices that is more like the ability to just know what to play next in the jazz improvisation, to just taste the food and know that it needs garlic salt. The ability to go in a room and say, oh, this is what's off. This is what this person is. These kind of senses. Some people talk about fields. Some people talk about intuitions. These are all getting at it. I mean, Bonita was making the point that's exactly right, is like, very often we think that that what transforms is we're becoming more rational or more intelligent, but most of our life is actually a result of changes in things we just see or just get or just feel. Like that can be a result of a lot of rational and reading, but actually it seems to be just this gettingness that we get. Well, how do you train that? How do you do that? What is that? And I think we're very interested in that.
Well, I think that the sensuality is very key in Ivan Illich, the senses. I know he wrote another book about the senses, which I forget what it was called, but that's very important. And all the things you've been talking about, he often says surprising things for a Catholic, renunciate, that hedonism, was one of his sort of, he's like propositions, but he didn't mean hedonism, I don't think, in the stupid way. He meant, I think enjoying the senses, and allowing oneself to completely dive into the senses. You're frozen. Is that me? Hello.
Hi. I think I'm good. Yeah. Hello there. I heard it. We heard everything you said about enjoying the senses.
Oh, you did. Hey. And then you were frozen on my screen. I don't know if that was me or you or what happened there, but.
Oh, it's all right.
Sorry about that. Not sure.
Okay. Anyway.
I would just say to that Illich would, there's this real funny way in which he would say, the problem is we don't have enough pleasure. Like we don't have enough joy. Like that's the problem. It's like people are settling for all these things like that are lame. He's like, you people are too lame, y'all. I was talking with Layman, Mr. Pascal, and this idea that the problem is today is people don't know how to have a good time. They really don't. Like, they don't even know what a good time is. And the fullness of time, Kairos, for Illich, religion is like, it has a lot to do with the festival, and that gets into Piper and leisure and all these things. It has a lot to do with the celebration of life. Like if religion does not celebrate life, then you shouldn't even call it religion. It's something else. Who knows what it is? It's some,
totally
some sort of schedule, I guess. It's a job, really. Like most religions are actually jobs. They're not actually religions in a way. And he just, we don't know how to have a good time. The other thing that we were talking, that Pascal was getting at, is the idea that we need to make our experiences more nutritious. Like we don't have nutritious experience, really. Like we don't, when we look at a tree, it's not nutritious to us. When we walk into a room, the aura and atmosphere of the room is not nutritious to us. And I think Illich is right there. He's like, we do not know how to have life be nutritious. We know how to eat food. And then he would maybe question that. He's like, I don't know about your diet these days. But like life is not nutritious to us. And it's certainly not on every level. And Ivan is very, very concerned with ways that, but again, nobody intends to live a life where life ceases to be nutritious. They slip into it.
In fact, the opposite. People are trying always to pleasureize themselves, but through simulated means, it seems, a lot of movies and getting drunk at office parties and, acting like a teenager when you're 40. I don't know. It just seems like the culture has lost even a dignified way or a way to celebrate. You always have to get drunk or stupid. Which is very sad, it seems to me.
Well, drunkenness.
I think you're right that the religious festival is the antidote to that. whatever that means. It doesn't have to mean a particular tradition or not, but.
Oh yeah. Well, the funny thing, like if you're like, if you get drunk, then you don't know how to drink wine. Like you're bad at wine or you're bad at alcohol, like drunkenness in the state, not the gladness of heart. Like if you don't, like one of the things I like would say is like, you know, we were talking movies and I know he didn't watch a bunch of movies, but it's almost like we don't have the ability to tell what a good movie is. We don't know what good art is. We don't know what a good time is because the problem is it's kind of a Kierkegaardian thing. And I think this is what concerned Illich so much. If you lose the ability to tell what is a good time, you've also lost the ability to tell that you lost the ability to tell what is a good time. That's why we're so prone to be manipulated, because if you are manipulated, you've probably also lost the ability to tell that you're manipulated. And that's why also it's almost like the world was not ready for Illich until manipulation was almost like easier to see, or it's like the AI is like people are more open to being manipulated. And then they're like, oh, maybe this Illich guy has something going on. The issue is if you take Illich seriously, it turns out that that manipulation was going on for a long time. It's just that now, because of the AI technology.
Now it's completely, absolutely transparent and in the open. It's like you can't deny how utterly banal the whole thing, the whole sort of human parade has become, it would seem. Like I was watching this like Apple commercial with Steve Jobs, and it was the biggest banality I've ever seen. And it's like people are eating this shit up and they don't know that there's some other possibility which is so much more alive and nuanced and humorous and beautiful.
Oh yeah, well it's the problem of ignorance, in the sense of we think like true ignorance means you don't know you don't know something. Like ignorance is when you know you don't know something. That's not the problem. Like the way that the system or the zeitgeist or whatever works is by having what you don't know be something you don't even know you don't know. And so this is one of the reasons why reading Illich can be so difficult, because he almost seems like he's speaking from another world. It's like, what are you talking? Well, yeah, it's another world because you don't even know that you don't know about the place that he's speaking from. And so like today, like you say, it's become so saturated, it's easier to see, but he was just very far ahead of his time in that way, where he saw where everything was going.
Yeah, totally agreed. Yeah. So this is great. I really think that, you know, it makes sense to read and look at Illich's work, you know, more now than ever. And will be increasingly so in the future. Not because he was like a perennial philosopher, like, you know, like some of the guys that you study, but because he was sort of, he has these little keys, you know, to things that you can that just open up, you know, a richer reality. That's how I see it. So a lot of the work seems very pessimistic, but it's not really pessimistic, even though it's utterly damning of modernity. In a way, it's quite the opposite, which is I've always felt, which is we have to face the horrors, as he would say, but at the same time, that's when a new potential opens up.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that you know, he has so many great insights. And I was thinking about like some of his insights on the medical world, just really quick, I wanted to touch on, because I find like the alternative health world very fascinating. I'm often drawn to just researching this and that and the other, and just looking into it and just be with a curious mind. And, you know, it's interesting though, because sometimes like there's actually some of the things he's saying from like a philosophical perspective actually lines up a lot with certain frameworks of health. It's not really like modalities or anything like this, but just this concept of like how the psyche is actually related to the body, you know, for example, and how there are actual, you know, the body is actually made to survive. So when it has certain symptoms, it's not actually like just this like, oh, I'm, you know, I've done something wrong and now I'm like gonna be like, you know, I'm have something horrible happening now because I've done something bad I did or something like this. It's like, it's actually the symptom is something that shows you something about what your body's doing to heal itself. And so it's fascinating to me, because I'm really interested in the fact that there's absolute overlaps between, you know, some of Illich's work when it comes to the medical establishment and understanding sort of the sense of the actual person in their own health, and sort of this idea that when everything is kind of like
given away to the authorities, right? Then you never ever cultivate a sense of like he really made me think a lot about like self-care, because that's like such a hot buzzword these days, you know, self-care. Yeah. But he had said something in one of his interviews about like how we will not be able to cultivate self-care if we're always giving over the authority and the know-how to those who are not ourselves, and in fear. Like fear is such a big thing that controls so many people. And I think that like for him, I mean, there's a real way in which like the idea of facing the horror and all of this is like actually to be not afraid in the gospel sort of sense of this idea of like, you know, not being afraid, and like, the, you know, the fact that perfect love drives out fear. And so if we're going to like really be fearless, then we also have to understand like our own capacity. But that can feel scary, because what if we're wrong? And like this relates kind of a little bit to the absolute choice, or like how do you make a choice for yourself, but that's still not like selfish and all of this, you know, where you get to be just self-forgetful in this, or the self-remembrance, right? So there's this, I just think it's really fascinating to me, because I think if we think about Illich's work where we tie it into some other fields, it's extremely revelatory. Like what he was saying is like there's actual like research behind certain health approaches or you know, again, like frameworks that really, 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 really like highlight his work. Like his work is so, you know, this was happening. It's kind of interesting though, actually, his work was in line with a German doctor at the time. And it's fascinating to me to think like in these two spheres, you know, there's these two men, but like they're both kind of coming at it from different angles. But if we really take, like, if we open up ourselves to that, which is sometimes difficult or unsystematic or difficult to pin down, or he's not maybe thought of as like a canonical, you know, in the way that maybe some other philosophers are, we'd really learn a lot that give us incredible insights and incredible possibly frameworks that really like change everything for us and can really like I think free us from a lot of the anxieties and kind of fears that get so even not recognizably ingrained into the modern, you know. So I just want to speak to that. I find it really fascinating.
Well, I mean, there's a sense, and I'd have to explain what I mean by it, is that the mind is more so the body than the brain. Like, we tend to say the mind is the brain, right? And Illich is like, no, the mind is the body, right? Like, you touch things, you smell. Like, we have this whole thing where the mind, or the, and if by mind you mean things like the self or whatever, like, we associate it with the brain. Here's the problem. If that is what you are, most essentially, then whoever has the answers or the thoughts is in control.
Yep.
You are controlled by whoever knows the right information, because the brain processes information. That's the mind. You're primarily the mind. Therefore, you're controlled by the computer or the state or whoever has the answer, right? But if, in fact, you're controlled
by your own thoughts.
Yeah, that's right. And you're controlled by your own thoughts. Whatever you think is truth, then you must do it. Yep. Or if your thought is, I suck, then you do suck and it's over, right? But if you say, no, wait, I'm actually more so my body and the brain is just in concert with the body. You look at your body's not telling you you suck. Your hand's not telling you suck. Your hand's still able to pick up coffee cups and go through the day, right? Like, we do this thing where the only problem-solving part of us is the mind. The only thing that's real is the mind. But the body is entirely in operation to do a lot more. It's sending signals on how to heal itself. It's sending signals. Like, and we also know, like, in a funny way, we do this weird thing where thought in the brain is all that matters, and then it doesn't matter at the same time. Because if you took that seriously, like, then stress equals you'd have worse health, which, by the way, we know, right? So the type of like thoughts you have literally have physiological effects on the body, right? So we know this, and yet we don't count that. You know, then there's like this really weird thing we do where like only rational thoughts are real, but stress thought or emotional thoughts, those aren't real. So we're very confused today. And Ivan Illich is kind of suggesting that we're very vulnerable in that confusion. And then we sell ourselves short. That's the other thing. Yeah. We end up selling ourselves short in how we're able to experience the world. Yeah. We actually are capable of having more nutritious experiences. Mm-hmm. We actually are capable of conditioning our lives and the places we go into to make friendship more alive, more vibrant. We're actually capable of all these things. And really, and Benita was saying this, and I think Ivan is also part of a long tradition of philosophers, I'll say, like Vicot, David Hume, Harman, Benjamin Fondane, who they're all the counter-Enlightenment thinkers or the modern counter-Enlightenment thinkers, who warn that philosophy was its own biggest problem, really. like thinking was its own biggest problem, because thinking has a tendency to think that everything is about thinking. And then it actually results in a certain devolution of the human subject in that act. And you have to actually fight thought to think well. Yeah. You actually have to make thought in service of the world in order for thought not to engage in its own self-effacement. Mm-hmm. And Ivan Illich is aware of that. He's part of this tradition of thinkers who's been, like you said, the problem is too, like a lot of the canonical philosophers that people read are actually just people that fit very neatly into the conception of human beings as the rational animal or as primarily the rational being. So actually the education system in that way contributes to further capture. But if you look at this other line of thinking that goes back to someone like a Foucault, and then, like I said, a Hume or whatever, there's this tradition of thinking requires an awareness that thinking is a problem. And how do we put thinking in the right order so that it sees itself in concert with the music of the whole body and the whole world, as opposed to replacing it?
It seems to me this idea that thinking is a problem is well known by religious traditions forever, right? I mean, since the beginning. I mean, if you were... I don't know. I remember hearing this story about this Chinese Taoist teacher who came to California and looked around and he saw it. He said that these people are ghosts because they were just thinking. They were just in their minds. They just completely detached from the body, and they didn't have any practice, you know, to deal with that. Like, they didn't have any way to dissolve their thoughts or question their thoughts, or sit in silence, or whatever it is that, you know, or liturgy, or whatever it is that people do to control the monkey mind, or, you know.
I think that's super important. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, the idea of thought being problematic is not to keep it as a problem. It's to understand that it is something you have to work with. And, you know, you identify that it can be problematic so that you can be less problematic with your thinking, you know? So yeah, it's a wonderful, wonderful tool in a way too. Like, thinking itself can be like thinking. It's funny because, like, you know, just to connect to the health thing really quick, people often think about like, well, what are they eating? What supplements are they taking? Blah, blah, blah. But they're not thinking like, what thoughts am I thinking? What are my thoughts, and how are they nourishing or malnourishing my body? And how do my thoughts impact, you know, the fact that my body has this deep connection with the way that I think and the way that we think about ourselves. And so it's really interesting. But yes, I think that the thing is that it is a way in which you have to sort of, you do have to actively kind of fight certain thinking so that you can think in a more holistic or more beneficial way, or a more refined way that then is very beneficial, you know. Then it's very like, you know, it combats that problematic element by, you know, with thinking itself.
Well, it's no different than, like, it's very similar to people going, what am I going to do today? What are we going to do together? It's kind of like, that's not like your thoughts or your intrinsic motivations. Like, what will the world give us that will make us entertained? You know, what can I put in? And you see, the problem is, ironically, that seems like you're honoring the outside world, but actually you're reducing it into a thing to make you feel better. And that's when it's
just a Disneyland experience or something, where everything
that's
is
correct.
Controlled and people's minds are becoming like that, you know.
And then, like, Heidegger basically, it's like standing reserve, right? And I think all of reality is standing reserve. One of the reasons friendship is in trouble is because we've turned the world into energy to stimulate our friendships, as opposed to learning to cultivate within ourselves the humanity that makes it possible to relate to people as friends. Like, everyone is friends. It's like, what are we going to do together? Oh, we're going to go to the movies. Oh, we're going to go to the restaurant. And that's not all inherently bad. The problem is, it can turn into junk food. Like, dessert or pie is not bad every now and then, but it can turn into a junk food if you're dependent on it, you have it too much. And so likewise, people treat the world as a thing, like the medication or the pills or the supplements, as opposed to treating the world as something they're part of and should honor. And I think that has ramifications for family, friendship, all of these different things. And I think with the thoughts point, the last thing I'll say on that is, you know, Augustine had that notion where he says all evils are a misordered good, because everything that exists is good if God created it, right? So evil has to be a kind of misordered good. Well, likewise, basically everything is a matter of order. Like, thinking is not
and dosage, in alchemy, it's like everything is poison unless it's in the right amount.
That's exactly right. And so if And that basically would say that everything is, like we were saying, the cooking metaphor or the jazz improvisation. Yeah. If the piano takes over, there's no more music. If there's the drums are too loud, it doesn't work, right? There's a kind of cooking that's described. Basically, what Ivan Illich is suggesting is that most of our metaphors treats reality like a math problem, very clean, the purity thing, 2 + 2, like figure the problem, when really life is more like cooking, which requires a whole host of skills to be capable of doing. And that also is why there's this emphasis on limit, because you have to limit how much salt you put into the dish or limit how hot it is, or it will not work out. But then there also has to be the risk of messing up or cooking the wrong things or making mistakes in the act of cooking. And you have to make your pie. And if the neighbor comes over and says, that's not how I do my pumpkin pie, you have to say, well, everyone is different and that's okay. Thus dealing with the existential tension we described at the beginning, right? So Ivan Illich is putting forth a more robust metaphoric structure, if you will, by which to approach the world. And metaphors matter, like Susan Sontag and Lakoff and all these people talk about, because metaphors are not merely decorations of thought, but the structures according to which we think. And so if we don't think of reality as cooking, then we're not going to treat it as cooking. And as a result, we're going to treat it binarily. And in being so binary, it's probably going to turn into junk food as opposed to a place in which we dwell and live fully according to music.
So that seems a nice place to sort of head towards a closing. Do you guys want to say anything else to pitch your course a bit, or just get, you know, convince people, like, instrumentally to just kidding, to sign up for your course, give us money, and to talk about these things? Okay. I'm teasing, but just any last thoughts about the course, and which I think will be very nutritious. I have the sense, yes, and enlightening and rich and interesting.
Thank you so much, Mr. Sweeney, and yeah, we're very excited about it. I mean, we hope that it'll be like a very kind of more, a little bit more in the spirit of oral tradition in terms of sharing some of our ideas and some of our concepts. And, you know, we look forward to those who are able to join and what they will also bring forth to the table. Because when it's about cooking, it's about what you make it in many ways. So, you know, we hope we'll make a nutritious, delicious meal for people to enjoy each time they come. And yeah, we're looking forward to seeing what people will bring to the table as well.
No, we're thrilled and honored to have this opportunity on Parallax and to be speaking about Ivan Illich and to be part of this network of courses, like with Benita and then Scout and Layman and different things. It's all very important. And I do think we are in an age where, given these new sociological realities without givens, we have to set our own limits. We have to be intrinsically motivated, that there is indeed new kinds of education that are required, new skills, new ways of thinking that are not self-evident and that you are not taught, and that therefore you need to learn them. And I think basically the world today is a place not so much of problems and solutions, but trade-offs, and therefore skills, therefore abilities to evaluate, better decision-making, ways to self-defend yourself in the systems. And those are all the things that are being offered at Parallax that we hope in the course to also present, and to provide ways to sort of test yourself on, am I in fact engaging in the right balance of these different variables in the situations? Am I helping condition the room so that people feel a bit more alive? Am I engaging with people to make them feel as if this is what friendship is supposed to be, not just a matter of transactions? So we hope in the course to offer some of those phenomenological pragmatic tests, if you will, and also to provide frameworks that would help us escape some of the systems that Mr. Illich is critiquing, so that we might be more open to the neighbor. So we would be honored to have anyone join that is so able this November.
Wonderful. And it's nice that both you and Bonita are using this metaphor of music a lot. I was a musician for many years, but also think that even what we're doing in terms of courses aspires towards some sort of musicality, some sort of let's say coherence, but also improvisation, that it's a creative experiment that I hope people benefit from, and I hope many people will come and get to know you and join us. I think it's going to be great.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, so Mr. Excited. Sweeney. We're thrilled about it.
Okay, so we'll speak soon then.
Yes, sounds good. Absolutely. Have a good evening.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Sweeney.
See you. Bye bye.
Bye-bye.